we've learned anything from these past couple of years, my fellow Americans, it's that personal medical freedom and liberty are in crisis. America Out Loud Pulse brings together the top experts in healthcare-related fields to keep you a beat ahead.
So, given that we are about to head into another fun year for most state legislatures, the big question is, given the last 3+ years, really, of what has been states acting in directions and things that we had never even thought possible, what kind of things can be done to really limit the power of the state to interfere with what's best for your health? I think that's a good question that needs to be addressed. Many of us had no idea the extent or length to which our unelected administrative bureaucrats, especially, would go to really intervene and put themselves between you, your doctor, and society in pretty much no basic, with no basic facts and just a lot of theories. And those theories were used to violate not only your civil rights, but in many ways, your right to your own body and your own health. So thankfully, we have somebody who's thought a lot about this, and in fact, just recently wrote an article or was interviewed in an article called "The Top 10 Things Lawmakers Can Do Post-COVID to Improve the Lives and Safety of Alabamians." And, I know this show is not just listened to in Alabama, but I think a lot of these maxims can be used for each state. So, Stuart, kind of give me a rundown and we'll talk through each one of them and just really how they apply.
Thank you. Welcome back, everyone. Thank you, Jordan. The 10 that we came up with, and of course, ran it through the Concerned Doctors group and was grateful that people appreciate it. I think the first one kind of has a lot of depth to it. Medical students and residents in Alabama should be required to undergo remedial training in the scientific method. Clearly, the people of our generation and older, the baby boomers, like we've talked before, are leaving their mark on history. And unfortunately, in the field of medicine, a lot of them have done great damage in the last 3 years. And they have caused these medical students and residents in our state, the future leaders in healthcare, to completely miss the boat on what the scientific method looks like. And like with any catastrophe, challenge, crisis, leadership training always is looking at, should always look at, are the people that are going to be the next generation of leaders, are they going to be well equipped to deal with this type of thing? Are we helping them? And that's why principles are always crucial to understanding what you're doing and where you're going. That's why the underlying principles, like in a pandemic, you don't need to quarantine the healthy and non-threatened, for example. The devastation of the secondary and tertiary downstream effects that you have no idea what they're going to do, they need to be addressed. You need to have the humility of understanding your impact, I guess, is another way of looking at it. And if you have these underlying principles, you don't want to go against them if at all possible, because you're just opening yourself up to new variables that you're going to have to contend with. The virology and public health principles that have been shuttered or ignored or rejected that we've known for centuries, some of them for centuries. It's just so tragic. You know, we've only known about viruses for less than 100 years, but virology, simple principles of virology, have been ignored to the detriment of millions, probably billions, by the time this thing is fully done with. But we just need to, for the future of medicine and the future of communities in our country and state and county, the people that are in their formative years of training need to be retrained, obviously, because they have gotten a horrible, seen a horrible example of what it means to be a leader in a medical crisis.
Yeah, and I would start, you know, one thing I think probably hopefully enveloping all this is pretty apparent, that at least at our academic institutions, the knowledge about what rights a citizen has, regardless of your best thoughts about what they should do. Amen. In a society that really depends on, I mean, what's unique about our Constitution is the negative rights aspect, meaning our Constitution is full of things that says the government can't do this. And so when it says it can't do that, violating that by the government is not correct. And so it's one thing that I would make a point to. I mean, we definitely need to teach what you're about to talk about, but we also need our medical students to understand basics about what our country is founded on and what the Constitution says about the rights of individuals.
Yeah. I was talking to one of the Board of Trustee members a couple of years ago for a major university, and it had come to their attention that a student graduating had gotten to the point, the curriculum had changed so much that the graduate did not have to have gone through a course in American history. And the board really seemed like got caught flat-footed, and it's been taking them a lot of effort to reinstate that simple requirement. I mean, why in the world did somebody along the way not think that the understanding of who we are as a country needed to be taught to college graduates? Not just high school graduates, but college graduates. I mean, we had to take it in Alabama fourth grade. We had to take, and I still think they have to, Alabama history. Why do you think that people can get out of college without a firm understanding of what our culture and country was built on, the fundamental principles? Well, it goes straight to another blind spot that was ignored of the medical, the limitations, the lack of hubris that led to these people taking charge and killing and hurting millions of people. I mean, this is the United States of America. I was listening to another podcast. I was surprised it had slipped by me with Brett Weinstein. He's that biological anthropologist. And he was in an interview with a guy in England. This was 7 months ago, I think. And the guy from England, Weinstein kept having to reiterate that, look, the Nuremberg Code, the fundamental ethics document for medical research, was clearly violated from the beginning of all this. And the guy, it was sad, the guy, very intelligent guy, kind of completely missed the point that he kept making. And that's the whole, that's an example of what needs to happen with these young people in the medical profession. They need to go through this type of, wait a minute, sit them down, make them listen to what why the underlying principles are so important, so that you don't do this to people in the future. The principles have got to, the moral, ethical, Christian, really, principles that need to be adhered to are there for their protection. They're not there to be mean to them. But anyways, we've said this several times, this whole thing has revealed the character of our country and the leaders of our country in particular. in so many sad ways. But that's, I think, the first one for a major. I think that I'm glad we put that one first on the list. Alabama, the second issue was the state health officer needs to be appointed by the governor. Alabama is unique because, as you know, Jordan, a private organization determines who our state health officer is. And the state health officer, and in Alabama, there are 67 counties. Two of the counties have their own county health officer, but the state health officer is the county health officer for the other 65 counties. That the power that has been given to the county health officer is immense, and we've never had to deal with it before until now. But clearly that law needs to be rewritten so there is sanity and underlying principles are not abused and ignored. Third was the disbandment of the Certificate of Need program. The Certificate of Need program or committee is there are 15 states, including Texas, do not have a Certificate of Need program. But it's this monopoly. It's a guaranteed monopoly for the hospital association and the hospitals so that they don't have competition. It is ludicrous. And I talked to a guy named Bob Moffitt of the Heritage Foundation again last week about this. He's written extensively about this. But no studies have confirmed that these certificate of need committees keep down cost or provide better care. Yet the monopolies in these states, these big mules like in Alabama, the Hospital Association and the UAB, they get away with it because the laws allow them to. And it's very tragic, and it's obviously...
Yeah, and for the most part, all they do is, you know, make costs more expensive and restrict care where, you know, again, a lot of times there's new development in areas. I mean, Alabama's a good example is we've had a lot of development in Birmingham down this 280 corridor, and it has taken, or did take a act of Congress and one governor going to jail. To try to get a hospital near people. Now, I don't necessarily agree with the way all that was handled, but you know, in many ways, the argument that there was a, you know, need for a hospital down that way, and there was a plethora of hospitals downtown, you know, with a, when a lot of things in medicine are time to procedure in terms of life saving things, it was pretty interesting.
Yeah, it's kind of funny that the one thing that shouldn't be a law was the one, was one thing that that Siegelman, who is just this awful fool, who was the governor and went to prison, it was the one thing that finally caught him. That guy was so corrupt. But anyways, the fourth thing on the list, and this is controversial, I understand, is that a pharmacist overriding my or your order. If it is a right of conscience, if they don't want to write a or fill a prescription for an abortion pill, I certainly get that. But I thought that the way things were structured is you and I have the authority because of our training and, most importantly, responsibility that if we write a prescription that is detrimental to the patient, we are held liable for that. Of course, if I misstate a dose or the timing of a dose of a medicine when I call it in, I'm grateful for the pharmacist to call and let me know, hey, wait, we got to look at this. And sometimes I'll say, well, that's intentional. I'm intentionally doing that. And they'll say, fine. But in the last two or three years, there's this idea that a pharmacist can practice medicine. And what I mean by that is they can say, okay, doctor, like you and I, you know, we have plenty of articles showing the benefits of ivermectin, for example, ivermectin or hydroxychloroquine. And there's one in particular that's been published that shows over 20 mechanisms of action. And last month, it looks like another mechanism of action of ivermectin against COVID has been found. But the point is, we have scientific evidence for that. If we, our training should allow us to prescribe the medicine. If a pharmacist doesn't want to prescribe it for whatever reason, I understand conscience, but this isn't a conscience debate. This is a his or the pharmacist's science trumps my science debate. And that should not be allowed because they do not have the right to practice medicine. I know that's controversial, but that's my assessment of the situation. Fifth is we need to be like Tennessee did a year or two ago and make ivermectin available over the counter. Sixth, which is Eagle Form and other organizations are supportive of this one, that we need to increase the age of consent from 14 in Alabama to 18. They are intentionally targeting minors to do these things that are just ridiculous, vaccines or whatever. Seventh was add informed consent to vaccines, which is a no-brainer. It's embarrassing that we have to add that one. Eight, protect free speech laws for doctors. We went over that last week in California, the ridiculousness there. Nine, do not allow the vaccine schedule for children to include the COVID shots. The COVID shots, as we've stated before, need to be outlawed, stopped, ended today. 10th, require autopsies of healthy adults who have died suddenly following the vaccine with appropriate staining for the spike protein. There they are, and we can go over more in detail if you want to.
Yeah, I think the kind of overwhelming thing is the state, for the most part, needs to get out of interfering with patients and physicians and the rightful relationship that they have. Because, again, the onus is on us to care for the patient. We know them. I will also state that the liability for whether those things work or not are on us as well. So if you're going to truly trust the physician, and you do in the court of law, I mean, again, what we do in the clinic is, whether the pharmacist agrees or the state agrees, it really does come down to the physician's held liable or held responsible for what he does. And if that's the case, then, they need to allow us to do it or be held responsible. And I think that's one of the problems. A lot of what I would argue is some of this state action, even now. I mean, as you see some of these documents come out from Australia and some other places where they're starting to put the onus back on the physician for informing the patient about the risk of the vaccine. A lot of physicians are surprised to find out that, what about the manufacturer of it? Well, the manufacturer, they're actually going to get immunity for the most part, unless there's fraud found. And the person that's going to be held liable is probably going to be the prescriber or the person that was supposed to give informed consent. And if I was a physician who was pushing the vaccine, I would be a little bit wary of that because they're going to pass the buck. And I think the buck's going to be put right in your lap and you probably don't expect it. So anyway.
Yeah, that's an important point. I think that Dr. Jim Thorpe, who is the lead author in the paper that we did, and we talked about that a few months ago, he has said this many times, that any OBGYN that supports the vaccine in pregnant women, he will testify on the lady's behalf because of the gargantuan amount of data that shows the danger of these vaccines to developing babies and to their mothers. Because the doctor should know. These doctors should know, and I would never have thought I would be on.
Or they also should know what they don't know.
Right.
And so I think that's important. Anyway, this is Dr. Jordan Vaughn, Dr. Stuart Tankersley. We will be back. Again, this is America Out Loud Pulse, always one beat ahead.
Cold and flu season is here. Wouldn't it be great if you had a way to minimize airborne viral threats? Well, now there is, and it's a povidone iodine-based antiviral nasal spray called Cofix RX. You might even say it's just what the doctor ordered. To reduce your chance of getting hurt, you wear a safety belt when you're driving. To limit sun damage, you wear sunscreen on the beach. Cofix RX is just like that. It's an additional layer of protection. It's sold by thousands of pharmacists and medical doctors nationwide. It's made right here in the USA. Again, it's a povidone iodine-based antiviral nasal spray. You've heard them talk about it here on the Out Loud Network over and over again. Check out CofixRx.com. That's CofixRx.com for a retailer near you, or use coupon code OUTLOUD for 20% off at CofixRx.com.
Here on America Out Loud, we emphasize optimal health, and air is the most essential element for life. The average person inhales over 35 pounds of air every day, yet we seldom think about how to rid the air of pathogens swiftly and safely when we need to. The Genesis Fogger Plus HOCL is the only way to quickly and naturally restore air to its optimal condition. Visit genesisfogger.com/outloud for a free ebook on everything you need to know about HOCL and receive a 15% discount on the Genesis Fogger with promo code OUTLOUD. With Genesis, you'll be ready for what's next.
These days, every time you turn on the news, it seems like there's a new threat to your health. Maintaining a strong immune system has never been more critical. Advanced nutrition company, Healthy Cell, created Immune Super Boost to help you strengthen your immunity. Unlike other supplements that don't work, Immune Super Boost is not a pill. It's a gel you swallow with ultra absorption of science-backed nutrients proven to support immunity, like vitamin C, D3, zinc, elderberry, and echinacea. These physician-formulated gels come in a small gel pack. Tear off the top and shoot it down, or mix it in water. Boost your immunity. Go to HealthyCell.com and use limited-time code OUTLOUD for 25% off your first order, risk-free. Love it or your money back. Guaranteed. HealthyCell.com. Code out loud. HealthyCell.com. Code out loud.
To America Out Loud Pulse with Dr. Jordan Vaughn. I'm Dr. Stuart Tankersley of ConcernedDoctors.org. Thank you for once again joining us. We are talking about the article that we were interviewed for. I was interviewed for, but of course it had gone through the list, had gone through the group of doctors on Concerned Doctors, and we're talking about the legislative session here in Montgomery, Alabama, that's about to start. And we thought of 10 laws that need to be passed in order to combat the horrific response that the public health and the private physicians who have supported it, unfortunately, the public health entities have forced upon us the last 3 years, and it's time that there needs to be several changes so that this never happens again. And we went through a few of those, and Jordan, if you want to pick back up with some interesting insight on a couple of those.
Well, I mean, I think your number seven is interesting. It says add informed consent to vaccines. Technically, we're still on the hook. We were talking about this at the end of the last segment, but we, you know, physicians need to realize that informed consent didn't disappear. And in many ways, especially if you've had negative outcomes, I was actually on the phone with a lawyer in California this weekend, and just talking to him about when are the lawyers going to get involved here and start taking plaintiffs' cases. And he was pretty interesting because basically he was saying that because these entities are so huge that it takes a while for them to develop a strategy, and they usually do it in a very coordinated way. And so he thinks it will come, but at this point, because the entities that they're dealing with, the Department of Justice, U.S. government, as well as these massive pharmaceutical giants, it's not one of these one-off, two-offs. It's going to be some biggins. And but in addition, the fact that there is probably a whirlwind to pay when it comes to physicians, media personalities, CEOs, such things that pushed the vaccine, this injection that causes an immune response. I think there's going to be an interesting finding that a lot of things they said about it, safe, effective. All such things are going to be held held to be evaluated. And that's some kind of position that I would not want to be in.
Right. What's interesting about that, there are several things that are of importance with that. But there is a very, very well-known and prosperous trial lawyer, large group here in the state. And the head of that law firm has been writing several times in his monthly or whatever diatribes that we need to support the vaccines. We need to support the vaccines. We need to support the vaccines. So here you have the people that would supposedly normally be protecting the average consumer supporting this catastrophe. I hope they are nowhere near the courtrooms when it's time for penance to be paid, because they will, here they are supporting it. Yet I hope they're nowhere near the courtroom when it's time for the trial lawyers to be paid for going after these people for doing this, because they were culpable, in my opinion, in doing that, in supporting this insanity. It's an interesting dynamic there.
Unfortunately for lawyers, they're good at being on both sides of the issue. Wherever there's money, I feel like that's right. What the side is. So, and then, you know, the other thing that, you know, lastly is making sure that this is not added to the child's vaccine schedule. I think, you know, that's, you can tell, is their ultimate goal. I mean, again, the argument for having this even administered to children is, has never been even remotely science-based. I mean, heck, even now, there's an article in Paul Offit talking about the New England Journal. He's like, the bivalent boosters, there's not even a scientific argument for. And it's just, again, when government and industry get together and push something, you need to always look to where's the money going. And I think that's what's really happening here. But the childhood schedule is really about shielding from true, basically liability. So I think that's their goal. So we should not be. But then again, I feel like the powers that be, as well as the government officials they greased the campaign wheels for, are their goal is not what's best for children. It's what's best for their pocketbook.
Yeah, the highly esteemed and well-respected Senator Dick Shelby of Alabama, really sad, sad guy. Family owns a lot of real estate in Tuscaloosa. This has been a dream come true for a guy like that. Here it is, a bunch of power and money coming into the state that he gets to direct. He and his cronies in D.C. got to direct. Thank goodness he is no longer our senator. He retired at the age of 99 or something crazy like that. But it was just an example of how the whole system imploded. It was set to implode on itself. And when the trap was sprung, who has to pay the price? Certainly not those yahoos. But the millions and millions of people that were injured, and our grandchildren with the $6 trillion created out of thin air over the last 3 years to combat this. No, it's just everything the government did, everything the government has done has been wrong. Maybe Trump's rejecting of the flights from China, to which he was castigated for. But
Trump continues to double down. And I think Malone is right when he says, Robert Malone, that you can't support Trump if he continues to support these vaccines.
No way. Yeah, no question. Yeah, I think, his time. I mean, he's done a lot of, in my opinion, true good service to our country. If nothing else, he didn't get us in all these wars. But he didn't. He exposed the media for being the corrupt mouthpiece for the Liberal Democratic Party, and there's no question about that now. The the medical industry is trying to catch up with the poor reputation that the media has over the last 3 years. I don't think we'll ever get that low, but I think that's undeniable.
It's kind of crazy.
He doesn't need to be. His time is coming and gone, hopefully.
Yeah, I don't know why he holds on to that one little.
I wonder if he has money, if he's making money off of it or something. I don't know. Mm.
Yeah,
he loves the money.
Yeah, it's that, or, you know, he really, you know, can't admit wrong. Again, most politicians are like that. It's not, you know.
Well, Jared might be making some money if he's not. Jared Kushner's son-in-law and daughter. Who knows?
Yep.
But, it doesn't make any sense for him to be wedded to this like he is.
And I think that'll be the separating issue between DeSantis and him.
Yeah, I think there's good reason to believe that.
So,
which will be fine with me.
Yeah, fine with me as well. But, you know, that's where I think a lot of people, I think one of the things that was interesting this week was Scott Adams, the guy who used to and still does draw the Dilbert cartoons about kind of the craziness and stupidity of office environment, kind of put up a video that said, look, you know, he basically evaluated the heuristics and said, you know, who won this bet was the unvaccinated. They in the end are the winners. And, you know, again, a guy that basically, and then he went on to have a Twitter space this weekend with a couple thousand people and basically was saying, you know, how did the experienced or educated or, you know, the experts get it wrong? And it's kind of interesting to hear his, you know, he's still somewhat defensive. He basically said he never trusted the government, but trusted them in some ways. But really the thing that was kind of the deciding point was whether he wanted to travel or not. So he kind of had the same argument that I guess Robert Malone and Elon Musk had, which was, I don't trust it, but you know what? I've got to travel. So might as well take the poison pill. I'm not sure I would probably, especially if I was that wealthy, I'd probably find a way to not have to travel. Stuart, because I don't necessarily think traveling for a momentary time is as important as a long-term health, but it's neither here nor there.
I'm with you on that 100%. I would not have gotten them, but you mentioned Musk, Elon Musk. Did I see a headline last week where he was injured and his cousin or something, young cousin, was injured by the shots?
His young cousin ended up going to the hospital with myocarditis. He himself thought he was going to die after his booster. So again, you can kind of take from that what his thoughts are about these things. I imagine it's not looked at in a good light anymore. And it probably explains why he went from being a fan to being somebody who questioned the narrative.
And in mentioning Musk, what the historical significance of his role in exposing the lies and deceptions by his purchase of Twitter and the Twitter files. I don't know if you saw it or not, but more and more data has come out, has been revealed through them this past weekend. I was reading that the shutdown of any information that went against the narrative that this was a natural bug from the bats of China, the absolute rejection of any type of media or anybody speaking out, showing the evidence that this was a created virus. It was quick and swift and complete, the shutdown of anybody and the defunding of anybody that went against his narrative, Fauci and Collins' narrative. More and more evidence is clear that they had to shut that down, because it is crucial for people to understand America hundreds of years from now will be remembered I believe, for two things up until this point. One is the founding principles of our country, and two is COVID and the response, well, the creation of the virus and the vaccine. Because this catastrophe that Fauci was in charge of, Fauci and Collins were in charge of, will hurt generations of Americans to come. Yeah. But it was interesting that that data came out, that more and more information that Elon Musk has allowed to come out. The details are staggering.
And it goes back to the questions that Adams was asking was, how did the experts get it wrong? Well, first of all, at least at the top level, experts were compromised. They had already, they were involved in not only the actual production of this bug, all the way down to the cover. And so a lot of times when you think about experts, understand that everyone has a bias, but some people have bigger biases than others. And if your bias is to keep your butt from being exposed as being the progenitor of this issue, that is probably a pretty big motivator to have your story be right, even as the evidence on the other side mounts. So, but the other thing about experts is, it goes back to your number one on here, medical students and residents need training in scientific method. Medicine in its academic state is much more a, brown nosing show than it is a critical thinking show. So meaning a lot of how you move up in academia and the expert or government ranks is by making the person in front of you, patting them on the back, making them feel loved and being enthralled with their opinions. And that has really means that a lot of people don't question their own priors. And I think you could see that with everything. It's like, instead they just want to confirm their priors and being right or wrong in the academic world. Wrong doesn't get you any additional grants or funding. Being right or appearing to be right or agreeing with those that are right furthers your career. And I think that's where we have to get back to where actual critical thinking and questioning the consensus is actually where people should be lauded.
Yeah, it's clear that people like Doug Kell and Pretorius, what's her name? The lady in South Africa.
Pretorius, yeah.
Yeah, the lady, man, you've been really on the cutting edge of the science of these clots. How they've gotten away with being in the positions, I guess it's decades of authority within their field has allowed them to continue on. But so many of the experts, world-renowned, world-acclaimed experts, have gotten this wrong. And they keep, doubling down to the damage of millions. I remember the Medical Association of the State of Alabama had four statewide calls to doctors that wanted to call in. This was very early on in the spring of 2020. And the renowned Dr. Michael Sag of UAB, world-renowned for infectious disease, kept promoting this remdesivir stuff. And I challenged him twice on it. And, of course, they stopped doing those calls because they, like they've demonstrated countless times before, dialogue is not allowed. But the world-renowned. Well, lo and behold, where is one of the leading places that remdesivir has been studied? Up in Dr. Michael Sag's lab at UAB. So it's just, chickens come home to roost at the local level as well as the international level, don't they?
Yeah. And again, I don't even like Kimberlin, who also is big remdesivir pediatric side. I don't fault these people for wanting to know about their medicine. And also, but when we talk about a conflict of interest, just like Fauci had, what we need to do is actually have physicians be honest about the fact that some of what, or if not all of what, is driving them to say what they say is confirming their priors or some personal benefit. And they're not pure. No one's pure. And so I'm not saying I'm pure, but I do think that when somebody is looking at something or giving advice on the public stage, if they have a vested interest in an outcome, they need to state it. And I think that's shown itself. It's pretty glaringly, both in our local level all the way up to Fauci himself.
Yep. So with that, we're going to come back on the other side of the break. And Jordan, you have some more updated information about treatments, potential treatments, and investigations of what's going on. And thank you for joining us once again on America Out Loud Pulse.
It was Henry Wadsworth Longfellow that said, "Lives of great men all remind us we can make our lives sublime and departing, leave behind us footprints on the sands of time." America Out Loud Talk Radio, liberty and justice for all.
You wouldn't go a day without brushing your teeth or washing your hands. What about washing your nose? I mean, your nose does filter the air you breathe, air loaded with bacteria, viruses, and irritants. Make nasal hygiene part of your routine with Clear. No messy bottles to fill, no drowning sensation. Clear is a natural drug-free saline with the added benefit of xylitol, which blocks bacterial and viral adhesion. Available in stores and online at clear.com. That is X-L-E-A-R.com.
Again, welcome back. This is Dr. Jordan Vaughn, Dr. Stuart Tankersley. And again, for the third segment of the podcast this week, I'm going to sit down and kind of talk through the pathophysiology of spike-induced disease. Last week, we were just talking about kind of how fibrin is really a big issue here. Obviously, we have the other issues that are talked about a lot, the inflammatory issues and the viral persistence itself. Much of that is acute or subacute in nature. But the real issue that I've kind of noticed in the clinic, and I will tell you I'm biased about it because it's kind of what I've spent a lot of my time looking into, is the fibrin deposition, the abnormal folding of fibrin, and how that relates to why people are getting chronic issues. So let's back up a little bit and talk about fibrin itself. So fibrin is an important component of your body. God designed us to basically, if we have some type of cut or some type of opening in our vascular system, he designed us in a way that allows the blood to stop. We call maintaining hemostasis. So meaning we don't want, you know, obviously if we cut our finger and we didn't have fibrin as well as the rest of the clotting system, we would not, that would not be a good thing for us because we would be very prone to ending our life quickly by just the minorest of injuries. Now, as in anything, it appears, especially when we consider our fallen state, these bodies aren't perfected, they are fallen. And so a lot of things that we have don't necessarily work exactly the way that they should work. Now, in a perfect world, a world, I would say, without sin as a Christian, you know, this hemostatic system, fibrin, platelet complexes, all of the such, would basically cover up the hole, and then the body itself would heal the area that's cut. And we can see that happening in pretty much, you know, from the even the cut that you get on your finger. If you got a cut on your finger, the first thing that's going to happen is you are going to bleed, but eventually that bleeding will coagulate, and then that coagulation will stop the bleeding. And then eventually, without any of your positive input, it's going to heal itself up to return to its normal state as quickly as possible.
Obviously, factors that influence that are age. If you've ever had your child have a boo-boo, it seems like their skin, as well as cuts, those things heal rapidly. They have very active repair mechanisms. But those things, as you age, they don't work as well. So that is one thing to keep in mind as we talk about who is more likely to have issues from COVID. And it's related a lot of times to the repair mechanisms. They don't work as well. So again, that is the design. But with all things, especially in a fallen body, they don't always work as intended. And especially as they get older, more exposed to time. What I would always tell patients, it's time plus gravity. It seems that both of those are cause most of our aging in our systems. And you can add in there just the fact that we're maybe intended to live forever, because we don't really know why cells stop dividing, but they do. And as we age, they don't divide as well, and they don't divide as consistently and as genetically similar to their previous divisions. So given that, when we talk about fibrin, what Risa Pretorius and Doug Kell had noticed, this is prior to COVID, was that there are structural changes in fibrin. And fibrin is this long chain that's almost like a mortar type function that precipitates out of your blood and kind of congeals into almost like a string or a wrapping. And then it kind of holds together the bricks of the microclot complex. So those include things like platelets, things like von Willebrand's factor, and a lot of other kind of cytokines and tissue factors. So, you know, that is what congeals out. But what Risa and Doug had started to notice was that in chronic disease states, when you look at their blood under the microscope, what you see is this fibrin is misfolded. And so when we use the word amyloid, amyloid is a word that is not a good word in medicine. It basically means we usually associate it with things like Alzheimer's and neurodegenerative diseases. But amyloid basically has to do with the folding of a protein and how it's abnormally, or what we call anomalously, folded. And when something's folded abnormally, that's not a good thing. And even these abnormally folded proteins can sometimes cause folding abnormally in perpetuity. And we call that prion or action. And that's actually even scarier type setup. But it's, you know, it can give you probably the nightmares that people think about when they come up with ideas for a James Bond movie, probably. But prion disease is basically proteins misfolded that then are able to teach or cause other proteins to misfold similarly. Now, what that really looks like, and what I try to tell people, and what I will attach to the podcast notes is, you know, imagine when we look at fibrin, we look at this nice, you know, kind of structured, almost like fiber. It's got, you know, again, it's not like perfectly squared out or anything like that, but it's overlapping. It looks very nice. It almost is like we would call just like a good spaghetti noodles on top of each other. When we talk about what amyloid is, imagine that same spaghetti or cheese or whatever, almost like melting or burnt, and it's misfolded. It's not strong. Its integrity is not what it used to be. And so those are things, when we look at the difference between an amyloid fibrin and a regular fibrin, the amyloid fibrin stains. And that stain is something we call thioflavin T. You can use other amyloid stains. But the reason it stains is because of its misfolding. And so that misfolding is an important concept to understand, because it's at that level that the misfolding causes dysfunction. Okay, so if you have fibrin, everybody needs fibrin. Everybody should make fibrin when they are cut, when they are injured. They should basically have fibrin come out of their blood. We call it precipitate, but it's in a soluble, meaning like it's in the liquid form in fibrinogen. But then when it's needed, it's cleaved and allowed to come out of its soluble form or liquid form and turn into an actual protein that's able to interact and kind of form and fold and basically almost patch up an area of the vessel. Okay. So it's very important, but imagine if it came out of its soluble form or its liquid form, and it came out not for any reason other than something like the spike protein in SARS-CoV-2 told it to. Now, that's not good. That's why when we talk about amyloid, fibrinoloid, or what we call fibrin deposition by the S1 subunit of the spike protein, why that's such something that should have been, you know, the first sign that this is not the protein that we should use, especially in a vaccine, but also that the protein itself is very abnormal in that it can do that, which would kind of suggest again that the actual protein itself doesn't appear, at least from what we can tell, to have occurred in nature. It looks more like it was manipulated by man. And usually things that are manipulated by man have secondary consequences that we don't predict. It's kind of, I guess that's probably a biblical lesson as well as a medical lesson. But men's attempt at God's design is usually, if not uniformly, lacking. So that is what we are talking about when we talk about this fibrin deposition. And then when we talk about resistant to fibrinolysis, so when it's resistant to breakdown, the reason it's resistant to breakdown is it wasn't built the same way. So it's not this perfect kind of spaghetti loop. I mean, if you took spaghetti noodles that aren't burnt and don't have a lot of cheese in them, you could pull them apart pretty easily. Imagine, though, that you burnt them and have a bunch of kind of cheese and other crap in them. If you wanted to pull them apart and, you know, send them back to a soluble form, it would be very difficult because they're all kind of interlaced, you know, awkwardly. And so, again, that's what really drives this issue. And so when we talk about chronic disease states, what Risa and Doug had noticed is that in things like type 2 diabetes or rheumatoid arthritis or other what we would call chronic inflammatory states, those people had a significant amount more of this amyloid fibrin. So it seems that there's a structural change, and structural meaning like there's an actual how it's formed is different in people with these disease states. And that seems to be a possible causative reason for them to have higher risk of stroke and heart attacks. Now, that was prior to COVID-19. I mean, even my father, for instance, who has Parkinson's, he, some of Risa's earlier work was looking at people with neurodegenerative diseases like Parkinson's. And it's interesting, as I was able to now do immunofluorescent microscopy and was taught by Risa to do it, looking at his blood, it looks like a starry sky. I mean, it's not the same kind of massive, you know, microclots that you see in COVID, but it is definitely different than my mother's blood, who doesn't have Parkinson's. Now, I wouldn't recommend everyone going and getting their parents' blood and testing. I'm just kind of more of a tinkerer and just wanted to make sure they're kind of my controls in some sense when I'm looking at COVID-19 blood. So all that to say, that's what is really driving this microvascular issue. So we have an abnormal protein called the spike protein that causes anomalous or amyloid deposition of fibrin. Again, burnt spaghetti, not just noodles on top of each other. And then it's done right there in the vessel, and it's not done for the proper reason. This vessel itself wasn't necessarily injured. It probably was a little bit from the spike, but it wasn't injured to the extent that the fibrin basically precipitated. And now you're stuck with it. It's stuck in the end vascular system, and it's very difficult for the body to break it down. So that is really what we're talking about when we talk about amyloid, fibrin, and then microclots. Not my favorite word, mainly because clots is inflammatory in terms of, like, if you were to walk into the ER and say, hey, Dr. Vaughn said I've got microclots. First of all, they wouldn't know what that was. Second of all, the only word they would hear is clots. And then they would be off to search and prove me wrong that you don't have clots. Now, these clots aren't the clots that we think about when we think about medicine, especially in the lay vocabulary. The lay vocabulary, we're talking about venous clots, and those venous clots are usually formed from inactivity or coagulation issues, and they're usually formed in the venous system and are dislodged into the arterial system, and that's what makes them what I would call acutely dangerous. Now, Microclots are dangerous, but they're not they aren't acutely dangerous, meaning they are already at their destination. And oftentimes, and pretty much all the time, they're forming at their destination. Their issue is they clog up the what we would call the train station or the delivery point. And when they clog that up, it inhibits delivery of one of the most important, if not the most important molecule to your body, which is oxygen. So when that is clogged, everything does not work as well. So that would be why when we talk about things like long COVID or what I would call persistent symptoms of COVID that are vascular, you have a diverse array of symptoms. And it is all based on the fact that every organ system in your body, every small, you know, from your thumbnails, hair, to big organ systems like your heart, require oxygen delivery. And if it doesn't get oxygen, it's not going to work very well. So that is why when we talk about local tissue hypoxia, it's a fancy word for saying that the train can't unload. So I kind of use the metaphor of a train. Imagine, obviously, you have the people at the train station are oxygen, and your red blood cells are the train cars. So in a sense, you know, when you breathe in air, it has partial pressure of oxygen. That is, those little passengers go across the train station, which is your lungs, and load up in their cars, which is the red blood cells. Your vascular system is kind of the train tracks, okay? So it is important. And that's usually if you talk about your pulse ox, when everybody is focused on their pulse ox, what that's really indicating is that your red blood cells were able to load up with their passengers, okay? It says nothing about their ability to unload, and that's where the big issues are. So when we talk about oxygen delivery, what we're really talking about is can those train cars or red blood cells full of passengers, full of oxygen, get to their destination? And if they can't, if the train station is blocked or overloaded or gummed up, then you've got a bunch of red blood cells that are full of oxygen, and they can't get what they need to be. So it's great that your pulse ox says 99, but it really doesn't matter because what really needs that blood isn't your pulse oximeter, it's your end tissues. So that's really where I'll stop today. But when we talk about microvascular dysfunction and what I would call long COVID or persistent symptoms of COVID, that's probably the best explanation that I have in terms of trying to get people to understand what's going on. It's a little bit difficult. Medicine's really, really focused on one issue type things, but this is an issue that requires an understanding of almost from engineering to basic physiology to pathophysiology to even basic chemistry when we talk about misfolding of proteins. So it shows you the complexity of the issue. And then next week, what we're going to talk about is targeting ways to reverse this. And I think that's where we've got lots of progress and hope for lots of people that are suffering. So again, this is Dr. Jordan Vaughn, Dr. Stuart Tankersley with America Out Loud Pulse, always one beat ahead. See you next week.